Welcome back. It's Sheep Stuff You Should Know, special episode. We are recording all three of us in person, Ryan Mahoney, Dr. Rosie Bush, and Dan Makin from the 161st annual convention. Wool Growers, California Wool Growers Association is the oldest ag organization in the state. And that's pretty darn cool. Well, what's going on? How have you liked convention so far?
I had to get back in in-person convention mode, man. Yeah. This is Zoom free. Well, it wasn't quite Zoom free, but it was Zoom free for the three of us, right?
Oh, for sure.
This
yeah.
is awesome.
Rosie has the giggles too, so she's going to just keep laughing this whole time.
I think that's post-convention syndrome.
Yeah, it's the 2 days of meetings kind of does that to you.
You get like a runner's high when you're giving these presentations. My heart's thumping the whole time. I love it, but it's just, and then you're done, you're like, you get, it's a whole different thing.
Hey, you gave three presentations?
I gave three presentations.
Yeah. And which one was the best? Which one was the worst?
I think the research update was definitely the best, but I also had support from Dan Makin and Selena Phillips from Chico yeah. State. That was fun.
I really enjoyed it. I was talking to Joe Posey half the time.
Yes, like I in saw the background. That. I was like, what the heck?
I did pay attention a little bit. But
you know, most speakers like to identify the smiling face in the audience that they can connect with. That was not you this time, right?
I'm sorry. You get talking and you just have, you know, get in these conversations.
I can't imagine any of us just getting into a conversation and just going with it. That's just kind of how it works. We have an audience, by the way. I think it's maybe time for the audience participation portion of the podcast.
I think she needs a drink first.
Yeah, well
Okay.
All right. So as soon as our guest has her adult refreshment, we'll have a guest. Ryan, let me turn this mic back over to you.
All right, since one of the things the convention always makes me think about, and we just had that amazing interview you were able to do with James Rebanks and his new book, and I've always loved his first book, A Shepherd's Life, was just so amazing at how it really articulated what and why people feel connected to the land, why they love ranching, why they are connected to these animals. And then the second book is gets into kind of a lot of the changes that he's seen over his lifetime. And one of those changes is kind of how community is built or is lost and is driven and outside influences changing the old time. And he's touched on a million of those topics. And I thought, sitting here, 161st annual convention, what a great opportunity to really dig into some of that discussion and have those kind of conversations that he asks us to have in his book, Pastoral Song. And so I guess the first question I would ask both of you guys is, why are these annual meetings important for the sheep industry?
That's a really good question, especially I think in a year like we've just gone through, where we didn't have a lot of face-to-face interaction with anybody. we did our convention last year by Zoom. There's only been 1 year in 161 years that the wool growers didn't meet, and that was during World War II. But I think so much of what we do as producers requires face-to-face trust, and you can't do that on a phone necessarily. You can't do that, certainly can't do that on social media as much as we try. And I think that's a really important reason for us all to get together like this. I think reestablishing those connections and being able to look people in the eye. We don't always have to agree on everything, but it's so much more productive when you can have those conversations face to face.
Yeah. And I think for me, especially coming in as a kind of an industry ally or allied organization, as much as I enjoy sheep and love treating sheep and working with you guys, I can't connect with you on that level, right? So coming in and having, I don't want to be the faceless person that just provides information. And I guess on the podcast, I'm a faceless person. I'm just the voice. But these face-to-face type of meetings are really incredible because then, you know, you see that human aspect, and it goes both ways. You know, like, I get to work with you guys in that way, and this gives us that opportunity to meet everyone in California, and or everyone who came to the meeting.
Everyone
in
California.
Way.
Yeah, there is 40 million people that attend this sheep convention. Oh, I'm sorry, that's 40.
40. Scratch the million. Sorry. Yeah.
You mentioned the face-to-face trust, and do you think that's something unique to agriculture and like the culture that surrounds ranching and farming versus other industries?
It might be somewhat unique, but I think maybe it's more intentional in the ranching community. I think this is kind of a cliche, but we've all had arrangements with our with our peers that are made on a handshake or nothing in writing, but we all live up to that kind of commitment. And I think that has to happen face to face. I think, you know, I think the other piece of it for me, being where I raise sheep, is that it's a little different maybe than Rio Vista, where there's still a critical mass of sheep production. And coming here like this helps me kind of reconnect with other people that are going through the same things I am. But on the flip side of that, I think California is so diverse that this is also a great place to learn about that diversity and to learn how other people are doing things that maybe you haven't thought of just because of their local circumstances.
The thing that really strikes me, especially being in person, is how everyone treats everyone like family. I mean, they're all families, right? They're even though not everyone here is related. There's a lot of history. There's a lot of there are a lot of relationships here. That's true. But it's, I don't know, it's incredible. Even if they aren't cousins or brothers or all of those, I feel like they're, for the most part, really good relationships through this, and, you know, really good friendships. And I think that's something that you wouldn't get with just the logo or just
right.
a phone call.
Right.
These are real families that, you know, truly appreciate one another.
You know, one of the other things that strikes me, and one of the speakers today talked about coming into how unusual it was to come into a room of agricultural producers and have it be mixed in terms of ages and genders. And farming in California is fairly male dominated, but it's not that way in the wool growers. And I just saw some ag census data that sheep production in California is by far the most diverse in terms of the people who own the operations compared to cattle or to dairy or to other operations. And I think that was reflected in the meeting today when you looked out at the room.
I mean, this is completely anecdotal, but I just got back from the Texas Sheep and Goat Expo, and the demographics down there were exactly like you're describing. They were so diverse, and I think they had a stat up. It was like 40 or 50% of the producers at that meeting had been in the industry less than 5 years.
Yeah.
They're all beginning farmers. They're all learning. They're learning how to live with the land. They're learning how to manage through environmental changes. They're learning through mistakes and through talking to people and through this community that mm-hmm. I think is absolutely essential to a healthy livestock industry. We're not, you know, I guess we're not not supposed to say industry anymore, but you know, it is what it is.
We weren't given an alternative word, so
yeah, exactly. But no, I mean, it's so important to be healthy. Like, to have a healthy ecosystem, you have to have responsible players. In order to have responsible players, you have to have community that supports each other and understanding, you know, between them, and the ability to learn. And I don't know, there's certainly a lot of competitiveness down here too, but that's natural in any business. There's something unique to livestock, I feel, and maybe it's urban rural too, I'm not sure, but you know, there's definitely something, there's a unique feel when you get into a producer meeting, especially for me, like a sheep meeting. It seems like there's a unique sense of togetherness,
mm-hmm.
you know, despite our differences. And maybe it's because we've been through so much as an industry. I mean.
Yeah. I don't know. You said the urban rural thing, and I don't know if I've said it before, but the growing up in a city, it really, that I didn't have that community that, you know, most rural towns have. Or so I think that's what really drew me to this kind of work and these kinds of relationships, was just more community. But then I've talked to people about it, and that's probably my unique situation. I think that there are some cultures in cities that are really strong on their communities, which is really cool. So, but I think it just really brings that back. Like, that community is so critical for survival, really. Like,
yeah, I think it kind of gets back to that shared struggle creates a bond that you can't really necessarily talk about, and, or you can't really describe. And I do feel like in ranching, you know, when you experience the highs and lows of livestock production, you really do go through an experience that's fairly unique in our culture today. I mean, it really gets down to almost life and death, you know. And on the ranch, you experience a lot of death. You also experience a tremendous amount of life, and how your decisions affect that one way or another. And just, I think that shared experience kind of bonds you, because you have an understanding that so many people don't get these days. And I might be getting a little philosophical and deep, but
no, I think about those things too. I think to jump back just a second, I think one of the differences with our industry, for lack of a better word, versus some of the other livestock production systems, is that sheep are really accessible. You don't have to go out and buy $30,000 worth of equipment to manage your five cows. Yeah. You know, it's a whole different system. And so I think that creates opportunities for people to enter the business that may be more difficult for cattle. But I think the other...
I want to jump in on that. So yeah. In Texas, I mentioned like less than five or whatever it was. Most of them were under 5 years in the business. Most of them had small flocks that had $5,000 to $10,000 saved up, that just bought some sheep and started a little business. It doesn't have the same overhead entry fee that, you know, some of these, especially like you look at the row crops.
Yeah.
Entry fee into row crops, like $500,000 harvester.
Yeah. Or almonds or any of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Sheep, you know, you just go to the auction and pick up a few Dorpers and you're in.
You're part of the club.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I also think, I talked about this with James Rebanks a little bit, and it'd be interesting to go to some other countries to see where sheep people are in terms of the social strata of livestock production.
Yeah, you know? That was a fascinating question.
And I think part of why I like getting together here at Wool Growers is that part of raising sheep in the U.S. is you got to be self-deprecating, because you can't have the ego that a cowboy might have, you know.
Yeah.
And somebody last night actually said that, you know, they call them cowboys, but we're sheep men. And I thought that was, I'm going to use that next time I talk to people.
Yeah, that's a good line. I like that. I like that a lot.
Okay, wait a minute. Where do the women come in? I'm sorry. I just had to say that.
I'm hoping.
Shepherdesses. Yes.
But nobody goes out and buys a sheep boy hat.
No.
That's true.
That's great.
Sorry.
You did, completely. So, One of the, I'd be curious, Dan, you're the old guy here, so I'm going to ask you this question.
Yeah, Sonny.
So one of the things Rebanks brings up in his book is kind of the push in, I guess it would probably be in the 60s, 70s, and 80s is when it really took off, the push towards efficiencies and you could almost say, I hesitate to use the word dependence, but a really high demand for chemical fertilizers, chemical pesticides, and all of these uses that are incredibly effective have some unintended consequences, but also have some really big benefits to the product being produced, you know, be it corn or soybeans or sheep. You know, what's your experience been, and how kind of do you relate to his telling of that bit of the story about the change in his landscape from a diversified, you know, operation to a monolithic single crop, accelerated, high efficient operation? I just, you know, from an American standpoint, what do you see?
You know, I think it's, for me, there's a lot of context to that whole question in terms of geography.
This is going to be a 2.5 hour podcast, just so everybody knows, so make sure you block out 2 or 3 days to get through this.
We hope you're driving somewhere a long ways away while you're listening to this, and you have plenty of coffee.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm sure it'll be plenty entertaining.
For us, certainly for us. You know, I think so much of that is geographically based to a large extent. I think since reading that book, and I'll come back to your question, but I read a really interesting article about a farmer on the East Coast who kind of started with a focus on local food. And there's this perception amongst our consuming public that if you're producing for a local market, you got to be small and niche and scale. You shouldn't be thinking about scale. And one of the things that we found when we were trying to direct market was that the price I had to charge for lamb at the scale I was producing it was beyond, if I had to go out on the income I was making from the sheep business, I couldn't afford to buy lamb. That's not a sustainable system. And so I think a piece of what I would like to talk to James about further is what role do our consumers play in this in terms of what is important to them? And so there's pieces of it that are important to them in terms of soil health and diversity and environment.
So to jump in on that, I'd love to unpack this and jump in if you have something to say, Rosie. But in that vein about the consumer, a lot of what he talks about is how you have the creation of the grocery store, the demand for cheap food has driven efficiencies in the industry and has put small farms out of business because they're more expensive to operate because they operate on higher overheads than a larger business. But there, to me, in my experience, whenever you enter a conversation with a retailer, they market all of these terms and stories that make the consumer feel like they're supporting that local sustainable type business, but it's really hard to actually have programs that are legitimate in their auditing that are truly doing what they say they're going to do. I mean, the best example, my favorite example, is the hormone-free lamb. It's illegal in the United States to feed hormones to your lamb, but if you put hormone-free on your label, you sell more lamb. And it's the same kind of perception. And so you open a big question there about how do you engage with consumers or the general public or the people who are going to buy these products and help them to understand what questions to ask and what they really should be asking for rather than being influenced by a social media influencer like at Flying Mule Farms or somebody.
Yeah. California sheep rancher.
Yeah.
So for those of you that are just listening and not getting to observe this done live, we have 3 speakers and 2 mics.
Yeah, that's right. We are low budget
so
production.
We are a very low budget production.
Technically a no budget. You're still operating in the red.
Yes, yeah. I think social media is kind of a double-edged knife in that regard. I think it's given us the ability to connect directly with consumers, which is great. And I think the folks that do it well, and I would include both of you guys in that, are pretty open and transparent about what's happening. I think we can too easily paint this bucolic picture of what raising sheep in California is like. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, in my experience, not to denigrate the retailers that all of us depend on, but that's the story they want to tell.
I think, one of the issues that I've heard recently is, they are constantly vetting and editing or censoring. The censorings kind of have a lot of negative connotations, but they censor a lot of videos. A lot of those videos that get taken off are pictures of lambs being born because there's blood in the placenta. There's a lot of issues with us trying to tell an honest story, but you can't share an honest story because it's being censored, because people are being offended by what they're seeing, and but it's the real story.
Yeah.
And like a lamb gets born, that process happens.
That's the best time
whether
of the
it's
year.
Labeled in Whole Foods under an animal cruelty free label, or whether it's in a trash bin, you know, yep. being given out for free. You know, that process happens, and so to not be able to share that is definitely a challenge, but it's reflective of this consumer that's driven by marketing schemes or marketing drives versus based on what they want rather than an understanding of how things happen.
Right.
And
but I mean, when it comes down to it, don't you think a consumer just wants to know that you're like, yes, it's a business, but you're also not like just in it for money. Like you're producing healthy animals and you have other things in your operation that are, you know, beneficial to the land stewardship that you're practicing. And like, I think that that's also really important. Like it's, I don't know. And maybe I'm totally wrong and too optimistic.
No,
but.
No I don't, I think that's right. But I think the other, the other piece of this is, so for example, I have written a fair bit about predators and about those types of issues with sheep production. And one of the things that constantly surprises people based on their feedback to me is that, yeah, I'm in the business of selling lambs that are going to ultimately be harvested if they're going to turn into meat. And yet I'm upset if a coyote or a mountain lion comes in and kills a sheep. And it's not...
Or a domestic dog.
And it's not purely an economic issue for me. It's that... that animal depends on me for safety.
So I had a conversation with my 12-year-old yesterday. We were walking back from the corrals that we shipped out of Nevada, and I can't remember how it came up, but we were talking about lambing and the orphan lambs and some of that. Well, she always takes care of them, and then, you know, when they die, she cries. Like, it hurts
her.
And I told her, and I believe it to my bones, if you don't care anymore and don't feel bad when that happens, you have no business owning sheep. And I think it's such a important lesson in that. And I think that's one of these things we share in our community of livestock producers. We do care about these animals. Our job is to get them to the best place they can be. We're trying to give them the best environment, because whether you're looking at it from an idealistic standpoint or a strictly business standpoint, both of those standpoints require a healthy quality animal, which can only be gotten by taking care of it and caring about it.
Right.
And if you start to neglect those things, it shows really quick, and you get run out of town. Because I think the number one person that actually turns in animal abuse when it comes to livestock are usually other neighbors,
right?
Like ranches,
right?
Because they'll see something happening and can't stand it anymore.
I several years ago posted a picture of a lamb that I had pulled and tried to save and ended up dying. And I posted a picture of the lamb because it was reality that day. And a friend who runs sheep in southeastern Oregon sent me a text, didn't post this on Facebook or wherever it was I posted the picture, and said, the minute it doesn't bother you to lose a lamb is the minute you shouldn't raise sheep. And it has nothing to do with the fact that that lamb would have been worth several hundred dollars at weaning. Has everything to do with that kind of commitment to what you're doing.
Livestock veterinarians get that all the time. How can you say you care about animals if your animals are going to be slaughtered? Why do you, you know, how can you even do this? And, right, like, our goal is to make these, the lives of these animals as healthy and productive and, you know, great as they can be until they get to the point where they can enter our food supply. We want healthy animals in our food supply. It's important for human health, and it's really important for animal well-being as well.
We literally take an oath.
Yes.
So one of your neighbors, Al Medvitz, told me one time that in our society we have this mistaken notion that death is the opposite of health. And it's not. It's part of life,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of what we...
Yeah, health is the time in between.
Yeah. So we totally got off.
No, this is brilliant. And I mean, this is exactly what I wanted to talk about today, because I think it really touches on, you know, how and why we feel connected as a community, why we come to these things. And I think these kind of conventions and get-togethers help reinforce what you're doing. It allows you to discuss issues you're having. It allows you to, you know, bring an issue you're dealing with to everybody else. We're pretty diverse in California in our production systems.
Yeah.
And I mean, I wish we had more sheep producers here, especially from the North States, long drive.
Yeah.
But you're able to hear what somebody is doing up in Northeastern California, and the people in Southern California will jump on board to help those people. And
yeah.
You know, this is where you do those things, and you really build that community. But so the next kind of step, though, I want to get into is land stewardship. And I cut you off there, I guess, on my question about the chemical fertilizers and things. And and I mean, full disclosure, we use chemical fertilizer. We use pesticides on our ranch. We target them. We don't waste them. We use it very specifically. We've been transitioning very heavily over to more compost type products for fertilization, and but still we use them. So I mean, I'm not asking this question as a I'm asking this question the same way that I think James Rebanks asks it in his book, from a farmer that has done these things, has lived in this community, and is trying to do the best for what they have. And so I'm curious, let's get back to your story.
Well, and that was the take I got from the book, was that he's asking you know, what kinds of things enter into your decisions about how you produce, or Knob Creek. But say that in the microphone.
I would like a bourbon on the rocks.
Lagunitas 805.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry, that's the most important part of the podcast.
That was the intermission.
Yeah. We will take drink free. If you want to send us fine whiskey or some good beers, we will take them.
We don't have any ads or sponsorships, but we will work.
We'll take free things.
Yes, exactly. So I think part of what James was trying to say there, and what I took away from it, was, and actually I digress a bit, he said one of the best things you can do is somebody who's asking or questioning your production practices, I think he put it, you can grab a mug of tea or maybe a beer and walk around the farm. And I think that's what his perspective is on all of that. I think part of it is internally to ask ourselves questions about what's best for the long-term health of the landscapes we're managing. I think the other takeaway for me was, and I think there is some valid criticism of production systems in our country to this end, is that we've forgotten that the importance of having livestock as part of those bigger production systems. That if it's soybeans or corn, maybe it is important to have cows or sheep as
part
of that.
So I just read this article in, I think it was Progressive Farming, and they had a whole section on carbon and paying attention to soil health. And there's a farmer back there that has built these little crates that's on an automatic mower run off of solar panels, that basically he plants in these 20-foot rows. So he runs a 20-foot row of corn, and then he runs a 20-foot row of cover crop, and 20-foot row of corn and 20-foot row of cover crop. And he runs these corrals that are on this automatic mower that he just pressed start on at the beginning, and they work their way all the way through. And he's been able to like triple the income off of his ranch by doing this, like incorporating this. It's getting back to this multi-species, multi-use. And I don't know all the terminology. I don't grow corn or know anything about it other than it, you know, tastes good when I barbecue it. I like the sweet corn. But like, I guess with the buffers, he's able to get this, with the strips, he's able to get the buffer effect, which has increased his yield on his corn. Plus, he gets the revenue off of the livestock, which was way higher than he thought it was going to be. I think a lot of that's just proteins that have gone up in the last year. He hit a down market, and he might not be so happy. But
I think doesn't some of that, to a degree, not this kind of ecosystem type of thinking, but that having a lot, I think a lot of row crop farmers, at least in the Midwest where they do corn and soy, have small feedlots because they use that byproduct. And so it's, you know, I think that that exists, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for doing more integrated, you know, farming with those systems that are there, but how we, like further integrate them.
So one of the criticisms always is if you feed grain to livestock, you're taking food away from people and you're wasting, you know, you're, it's a negative effect. I have an opinion, but I don't know. I just have a really strong opinion. But what do you guys, is that true? Is that false? Do the livestock convert forages? I mean, the common response is the livestock are going to, the rumen's going to convert grass into more consumable pounds more efficiently than if you just feed a straight ear of corn off of a corn stalk to a person.
So I think that's also a complicated question in my mind.
All things.
So I'm the quintessential farm advisor. Every answer is it depends. I think.
But doesn't that? We say that every time. It depends. But isn't that the point that we're really unfolding?
Absolutely.
Yes, it depends. It's biology. It changes.
Absolutely. You
need landscapes. We don't have flat land where we can plant ears of corn across America. We have mountain ranges. We have deserts. We have land that we can't plant these things where livestock flourish.
I think the other piece of it, I did ask James about this a little bit. There's these trade-offs involved in all of this too, right? And there's, so on the flip side of I think where James writes about, there's folks at Davis who are working on this. Thank you. It's okay. Cold and open is my favorite beer.
Drinking a lager and get an IPA, you're gonna make a face.
I'm good.
Sorry for the pause.
Close enough.
Yeah.
Yes, they are. They are. So there's this idea that a purely grain-fed system is more efficient from a greenhouse gas perspective because you can get animals done earlier, right? And there's this other perspective that a purely grass-fed system is better for everybody. And I think the real answer is
both and.
Yeah, exactly. And
cows on corn. Cows aren't raised on corn their entire lives.
Right. Yeah. Right. But by the same token,
but then you do have like hogs and monogastrics. Animals, they're going to be raised on all corn, and they have highly efficient systems. I mean, is that an issue? Like, I don't know.
I'm totally into the miracle.
Do they occupy?
Based on the barns, or based on the protein produced per acre? Yeah.
If we're worried about human energy that we can get from a certain allotment of land. Those pigs are upcycling whatever energy they're taking in into an energy product that we consume that's higher than whatever they were able to take in, especially based on the acreage that they occupy. That makes no sense at all.
Totally, totally contradict that, though. Okay, cool. So to play devil's advocate, I think personally we in American agriculture have for a long time, for all of my professional life, have talked about how efficient we are, how much food we can produce on an acre. And that is an important measure. I think maybe we need to flip that around when it comes to ruminants and grazing animals. I think this is totally my bias as a guy who's worked in rangelands all my life. We need to talk about how many acres of rangeland we can keep in rangeland because we've got livestock grazing on it.
I can go so many ways right now, and I don't know which one to take. But I love that point because I think, and I'd love for you to elaborate a little bit. How has the rangeland changed over your career? The utilization of the rangeland and the health of the rangeland, rangeland. I've only had one. But I'm excited, all right?
So I think one of the major, probably the most significant change in rangeland in California in my career is that it's totally been fragmented. If I think about where I grew up in Tuolumne County in the foothills south of where I live now, it was grazing land and timberland, all of which was harvested either by logging or by grazing. And lots of those ranches now are 5 or 10 acre ranchettes, and there's no fences, or the fences have been let go. Same way in my part of the foothills now. And I think fragmentation is a big piece of that. And that fragmentation has been driven to some extent by the fact that there aren't people willing to do what we all do.
Do you think a lot of that fragmentation too has come from, you can call it urbanization, or you can call it absentee land ownership / when you have a rancher, or if I guess I'll ask my question in the form of a statement, which is my favorite way to ask questions. If you have a ranch and the person lives in that community, on that piece of ground, in that area, they're not going to let it go to heck quite as easily as somebody that's living out or doesn't have a vested interest in the ecological health of that property.
I think there is a relationship between the ecological health and the economic drivers within a community. I also think, though, that part of what has happened to us is that people see that kind of lifestyle, whether it's raising sheep or cows or whatever, and think, I want a piece of that, but I can really only wrap my head around 5 or 10 acres. And we see this, getting back to young producers and new producers, we see this misperception that here in California, I can get by on 20 acres of dry grassland and I can have a viable business with that, right? And there's not the understanding of what that land can carry, that there's a biological limit, ecological limit to what that 20 acres can support.
Right.
And so we've kind of lost sight of the fact that if that land's supposed to be productive in terms of grazing land, it's got to be bigger tracts. 20 acres seems like the world to somebody who's been living in a city lot. Mm-hmm. And yet, when you take somebody out there and say, this will support one cow for a year.
So one of my lessons I learned in life is never make your stocking decisions towards the end of spring. always make them at the beginning of winter. And I literally just had that conversation with someone out of Oregon. We were joking about, there's sheep for sale. Well, it's springtime. Let's buy them.
No.
Make that decision when there's no grass, not when there's lots.
Yeah.
But it gets to your point, though. You go out, you tour a property, you see a lot of grass, but then you put one cow on it and it's gone in 3 weeks and you're like, wow, that thing can eat.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to get back to the absentee landowner because I think that should be maybe better defined, because I know there's a lot of landowners that don't occupy or even run livestock on their land, but are really, they care about what happens and they're very active with the people that lease the land. And so absentee landowner doesn't necessarily mean that they're not running livestock or they're not involved. Absentee landowner means
when I'm talking about an absentee landowner, I'm talking about a $1 trillion hedge fund that owns 100,000 acres in somewhere in California. It's the people that don't, they have an expectation, they have an idea in their head, but they don't understand how much, how much sweat equity it takes to actually get that. I mean, rotational grazing is a great example of that.
Yeah.
It's the best thing you can do for pasture. It takes a lot of labor and a lot of time to actually do it.
Yeah.
And you have to have a person that knows what they're doing. So you try to implement it and you just say, we're rotationally grazing now. You're not going to get anything done.
I've got a blog post that's been percolating that someday I'll finish. But I would also add to some degree into that absentee landowner mix, and some of my friends will probably be offended by this.
That's what we're doing today, and that's why you're on your second beer. By the third beer, you're going to offend everybody you don't know, too. Everybody's going to be mad.
So, you know, there's a lot of ground in our part of the foothills that's owned by land trusts or has become regional parks, and they're all committed to grazing, and that's great. That's absolutely great. There is a difference between somebody who's committed to grazing and somebody who has an economic reason to be on a piece of ground every day, 365 days a year. And I think that's part of the struggle that I see in the foothills, in that we've got this commitment to maintaining grazing as we conserve lands, but there's not somebody for whom it's a bottom line situation to be out there every day.
And I think the other part of this, and we have the wildfires going right now, which is a really big issue, but in our area, we're in the Delta, and so flooding's our biggest issue. Our biggest challenges that we have are agencies that own ground that are making the decisions from miles away or even in Washington, D.C., and they don't clear out a drainage ditch that needs to get cleared out because of the environmental benefit of the tree that lives in there. But then the flood comes and it destroys the whole upland ecosystem all around it because they didn't take that one tree out for that one.
Yeah, cows are swimming.
And so there's a really huge disconnect the further away that decision making process is from that farm itself. And yeah, you got something to say. All right. So that was one of the other things I really appreciated in his book was about how he really encouraged that the rancher gets a seat at the table. When we have discussions, you have lobbying organizations, you have environmental advocates. I mean, just the name, they're advocates. And they're the ones that are all lobbying for land use. But a rancher is almost dismissed or is too busy to go to the meetings and his input won't be valued. But they have the most on-the-ground local knowledge of, when it floods, where the flood comes from. Right.
Yeah, and it comes back to kind of what we've been talking about this whole convention is like we have to be involved and we have to be present ourselves as the expert on the ground. If we're, someone has to make themselves available to have those conversations because a lot of times we say we are too busy.
But then how do I make time to be at the Central Valley Flood Control Agency meetings, go to the North Delta Water Agency meetings, go to the Delta Conservancy meetings, go to the Delta Stewardship Council meetings, go to the Water Resource Board, go to the Department of Water Resources meetings, read the minutes, and that's just water.
But that's where you're involved with the meetings that will represent you at those, right?
Yeah, exactly. But a lot of times those lobbyists, like a Farm Bureau is a great example. They're at all of those meetings. They lose a lot of their clout because they're a lobbyist versus an advocate that's sitting at the meeting. The advocate is paid staff for an organization that's there and is getting all expenses paid. But because they're an advocate, they have that vested interest like a rancher would, but because the rancher sent a lobbyist, it doesn't necessarily pull the same way.
But what about your reclamation district manager who is hired by a board?
Yeah.
They
do you know one?
I
by
do.
Chance?
They represent the landowners, mm-hmm. and they're not a lobbyist. They're not a politician. They want nothing to do with politics. They want to do their job. But they can represent their landowners in those ways. So I think there are some instances where
Oh, absolutely,
works.
There is. But I think the point is as we evolve as a society, we're having more and more of these special focused meetings, and it's harder and harder for that. Like, you take that and you have a small farmer with 160 acres that, like in the book, Rebank's grandfather. Like, he has no physical time to go to any of those meetings.
Right.
But yet, every single day, there's 2 to 7 meetings that people are having about his land.
Right.
And he can't be there. And it's just more and more of these every day without the understanding of that on-the-ground deal. Anyway, it's just a struggle. I don't have an answer. He is.
I've had that conversation with ranchers at home. Joe Fisher, who we all know, talks about, for every hour that he's at a meeting, he's paying somebody else to do his work less
telling people who are paid to be there what they need to hear, and then they don't listen.
Right.
It's so deflating.
One of the questions I had for James, and I thought a lot about the answer that he gave, was what role does science play in all of this? And I think, I think there is, we live in a weird time in terms of people's perception of what science is and what science can do. I think one of the things that I find so interesting in my, both as a rancher and as a kind of a scientist, is that there is so much knowledge in the room that we just got out of in terms of how the land will respond if it does X, Y, and Z, or what the sheep will do if we get this amount of rain in April, or where to put the sheep if this happens. None of that is based on experimentation.
We had a piece of ground that hadn't been grazed in 15 years. I said, we got a lease on it, and I asked my grandma, what do we do? He knew exactly how to get that ground into a healthy condition within a year.
Yeah.
And it was a different grazing process than normal grazing. Like, that's knowledge that you can't find in a textbook.
No.
That's knowledge from experience that, you know, that just, it's, and we it lives in the soil.
We can't afford to discount that knowledge. And that takes somebody being out on a piece of ground day in and day out to build that knowledge.
I think we also live in a time where science is maybe not as, I don't know, science should be criticized, right?
Right.
Anything. It is, right?
And you talked about that
you
today.
You should be testing a negative. You should be, you have an idea. You should be proving it wrong. You should not be proving yourself right. And that's kind of where there's a bit of a disconnect in the science community, is there's a lot of research, not a lot. There is research that I have seen that goes on where you're like, well, you've just proven yourself right. You haven't actually tested this hypothesis. So then there is distrust in science. But there should always be, right? Like, we should always be questioning these things that come out, but also right there, what we talked about today, there is those science kind of, there's a step ladder to science. So like you start.
Isn't there like two defined rules in science that are absolutely provable? And it's like gravity. Isn't there something like that where it's almost impossible to actually 100% prove that this is exactly what it is? It's science is the questioning of things. It's not the absolutes.
Yeah, it's literally the most humbling profession. And there is one of those things where a negative answer isn't actually, I mean, yeah, it's a problem when you test your hypothesis and it doesn't go the way you expected it to, but that's also information. It, you know, like there's, so it's, the way science is viewed is a little bit different now than maybe it was 10, 20 years ago.
I will just say, the older I get, the more I believe in gravity.
So I'm going to use this as a transition to bring us all the way back around from, science created these incredible advancements. So we got antibiotics, we got fertilizers, we got pesticide controls. We are able to change our existing ecosystems so quickly now with these new developments with science. Mm-hmm. Have we overstepped? How can we be cautious to make sure that we're utilizing these incredible tools and blessings that we have as a community, but at the same time not abuse them? There's like 8 questions there. I'm going to keep asking questions until someone starts talking.
You have a pen I can write all those down with?
Yeah. But I only have a sticky note to write them on. So.
I think that's a hard one, right? Because we've found the silver bullet, right? We've done these studies, we've found the cure. Now everyone wants it, because why shouldn't you use it?
Do you think that we found a silver bullet? Do you think that is a mentality that we have as a culture, that
totally.
We want a silver bullet rather than recognizing there is no silver?
Veterinarians should have a crystal ball and a silver bullet. Those are the only tools we need.
Well, yeah, of course. You're saying you don't?
No.
That's surprising to me.
I have this squishy stuff between my two ears, and that's the only way.
I think part of it is embracing complexity and gray area.
Yeah. Checks and balances.
Yeah, and maybe that's where science and practice need to come together better.
And it depends. Right?
Yeah. and embracing complexity rather than being intimidated by it.
Yeah.
I think maybe that's part of what I took out of James's book is that we've tried to simplify these systems rather than embrace the complexity.
Which is incredibly, I thought it was interesting because when during the interview, he talked about, I want to simplify my farm. I want to simplify everything. I want to simplify it. And then in the book, it's, we're simplifying everything. What are we doing? And I think that deserves a little unpacking. Do you kind of, you know what he means there when he's saying that?
I do. I think, you'll get to see the video of this and you'll know why we're laughing. So I think what he was talking about in terms of simplifying, and I think this has kind of happened with us, you know, I used to say that I drank the Joel Salatin Kool-Aid at one point, and I was going to have vegetables and do firewood and Christmas trees and eggs and pastured poultry, meat and sheep and goats and grass-fed beef. Did I say Christmas trees already?
Yeah.
Okay. I like those.
You can grow them twice a year. It's okay.
Well, they were free range, so they were kind of hard to catch. But in any case, that was a really complicated business that made me absolutely no money.
Yeah.
And had no time to do anything with my kids or have a life outside of working all day. And I think that's kind of what James was talking about in terms of simplifying the farm. But there's different ways to look at simplification and complexity. And so I think in terms of our looking at my operation, we've got more diversity in the landscapes we operate on and the vegetation that we graze and all of those things. But the business model is much simpler than it was 15 years ago.
I think, too, we've trained ourselves to hone in so well on certain aspects of an operation, right? Like, even if you produce lamb, you probably are really good at one aspect better than you are at a different aspect, right? So we tend to focus on the areas that really excite us and we're really good at. And this whole complexity issue, like maybe 50 years ago, we weren't so honed in and we were a little bit better at coping or handling or dealing with the big picture. And so maybe that's a culture thing. I don't know. But I think that, I think exactly what, like, diversified farms wasn't uncommon.
They were also poor.
Yes, that's
and
true.
Suffering and
I'm not
worked
saying we
so
made
hard.
Money off of
and
it.
They had 10 kids and they didn't pay any of the kids. I mean, it was a hard life.
My grandpa was one of 12 and he left.
You know, that's the one thing that I think a lot of people lose the context of is that idea of that small traditional scale farm is a really hard life. It was a really hard life. And if we want to support that as a society, we have to make sure that we figure out a way to fund that correctly.
Look at where we've come by focusing in not only production, but animal health.
We've created
mortality.
The greatest food secure nation in the history of the world.
Yes.
And that's allowed us to podcast through an iPhone because of the food security. So, I mean, there's benefits to this. But
absolutely.
Like, there's also benefits to that old traditional system. There's benefits there that
it's just a totally different mindset, right? Like, it's really hard to be really productive and focused on something that's getting you a direction, but also have that big picture approach. And people who have that are really gifted. But that's, I don't know.
So I read another book by a British shepherd, mostly focused on sheepdogs.
You know, I'm starting to think that these British shepherds have way too much time on their hands if they're writing all these books while they're working sheep, because I have no time to write a book.
Maybe that's what we need to ask James. But one of the points he made was that on his farm, 100 years ago, 300 sheep would have employed 10 people, and they would have all, it was hard work, but they all had shelter and place to live, something to eat, that sort of thing. Today, that farm still supports 300 sheep, but he can only afford to have himself working it. And so I think part of it is this change in how society has emphasize the importance of food.
But that's come with when it was employing 30 people, their life expectancy was 55 to 60 years old. Now life expectancy is 80. And that comes from this
absolutely
new food system that we have. And so how do we find this balance?
But it's not just the new food system.
No, it's everything.
It's the economic, it's all of that, but it's also the, if you look at the percent that the average person in this country pays for their food and compare it to the rest of the world, it's like less than 6% now.
But isn't that because of the wages earned in this world, not so much the dollars that it takes? Because it takes the same money to feed yourself 2,000 calories a day, it's going to cost you the same. And so if you're making twice the income as another nation, you're going to spend less as a percentage.
But I would flip that around and say, how important is that to the people that buy what you and I produce?
Oh, I agree that, but I think that to me, that statistic, because it was in the book a lot of times, and I really have been thinking about it, because it hits home and it challenges my, it challenges me. And when that happens, I think about it.
Yeah.
And I ask smart people that are smarter than me, like you guys.
Where are they?
I buy them a couple of beers first, and then I ask them. But I think there's, I lost my train of thought now. But I think there's, I don't know, there's... Yeah.
I get what you're saying, and I do think there's an element of that in terms of income.
That's a little statistical tweaking,
but
I think.
Also think that income is partly due to the fact that food is so cheap.
Is food... So, okay, little different thing. Here in California, we like to regulate farmers on how they can produce food. So producing food is more expensive. Is that reflected in the grocery stores, though, when we have food imported from other countries where it's less expensive to produce? Right? So is that maybe part of how much...
Well, and the biggest criticism in the American lamb industry is that Australian and New Zealand lamb can be produced cheaper than it is here. They import in, they undercut our prices, and we're not able to charge what we need for them. One of the reasons we have this huge price spike is because COVID screwed up all the international trade, which has kept a lot of that product out. So, you know, absolutely. That's a huge factor. And as a farmer, how can you change that? How can you change the basics of economics and economic pressures, price discovery? You can't change those formulas. Those formulas are there. If you're living in a free market, they're going to be there. You can go and do price fixing, but that doesn't work. That usually that bankrupts most industries within 10 years. So you can't do that. The free market works the best to keep people producing that food. But how do you take that smart approach? How do you take that educated approach, that informed approach, to not put people out of business because you're fixing the price, but then also don't allow yourself to be susceptible to false marketing schemes, cheap product, cheap. And this isn't saying that Australia and New Zealand is cheap product. They do a phenomenal job monetizing the whole value of the lamb.
Right.
They get more money per pound for their belly meat and their offals and the other cuts than we do.
Right.
And that allows them to sell their racks cheaper than wheat. I mean, it's
the whole picture.
It's because they're doing a great job. It's not because they're producing a cheap product. They're producing a good lamb product that is being monetized very well.
Right.
So anyway, I got to put that disclaimer in there. I don't want to lose our, I don't want to lose our 1% of Australian listeners.
Is it a whole percent?
Yeah, it's a whole percent.
All right. Heck yeah. Cool.
Yeah, with 3% Canadians, too.
That's so
we
awesome.
We love our Canadian partners.
We love all of them. Yeah. Oh, I forgot what I was going
to
say.
I don't know. We're trying to get rid of our country of origin labeling, too, for our Canadian partners. Yeah. Sorry, that's getting political. Now we're getting fired up. Wow. I just got kicked.
I can tell that he's finished his bourbon.
I just got kicked off the podcast. So thank you guys for a great run. It's been fun. I got fired from a pro bono 501c3 volunteer position.
We're not even that
bad. We can't even finish a thought here.
I think this is so important, though, and I love these kind of conversations. Is why we go to convention, because you can have these conversations, you can have these discussions, and this is what builds community. This is what we're built from, and if you're driving change, because I think we are rediscovering the importance of soil health in the overall farm. I don't think we understood how to look. I never knew how to. My grandpa never knew how to look at soil. He knows how to look at plants, and he did a really good job taking care of his soil. But it wasn't because he was knowledgeable about soil. He just he paid attention to the livestock and the rotational grazing and different things. But anyway.
And that's where I not to divert us. You're trying to draw us back to your overall theme, but I'm going to take us off on another tangent.
Fine, I'm giving up. I already got fired, Dan.
No, but I think that's an important point in the relationship between science and practice. So science may be able to tell us what healthy soil looks like in terms of all of the life in the soil and quantifying it and naming it.
But we really just look at nitrogen and carbon.
But your grandpa knew what it looked like from what was growing on top of it.
Exactly.
He couldn't tell you the name of that little bug or that protozoa living in the soil, but he could tell you what it looked like when it was right.
And this is where criticizing science comes in, right? Because some papers will look at the different colonies of fungi, the different types of bacteria in the soil, the different nitrogen, and some papers will use nitrogen and carbon as indicators. And sometimes that works, and sometimes, I am not a soil scientist, so I probably not.
Well, but I think you're onto something, and that's one of the points in the book that he brings up, is that so many of these, you make a pasture management plan, you get somebody from a university that met with another guy from extension that met with another person from this academic circle, and they say, this is how you need to run your pasture, and they don't bring that farmer into that equation. And a lot of farmers are just learning how to do this, but that farmer has a value. They have an understanding of how to get that ecosystem to be healthiest, because the animal that's grazing there does the best when it's healthiest. Yeah. I think it's not a,
right? There's an art to it. We see this a lot in vet med. There's science, but especially with small ruminant medicine, there's not the science we apply from other places. So there's an art to it. You know, like you make informed decisions, but you have an eye for it. You have experience with it. There's also an art form. There's, the way that it is applied is important. And that's where that experience comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the key points is that, and I think where you have a leased situation or absentee landowner situation, one of the downsides of that is that encourage, especially if it's a shorter term lease, it doesn't encourage those long-term decisions. And where my grandpa did so well, when I talk about pasture health, he was looking at the pasture health from a long-term perspective. You need this to produce the best lamb this year, next year, and 10 years from now. And if you short it and push it all into this year, you end up giving up all of your production long-term. And I think there's actually a lot. I was talking to a winery, a grape grower, and they sold a vineyard and they pumped a bunch of nitrogen to it to maximize the production. Well, that one action suffered the vineyard for 3 years following, because that ecology has a limit. You know, that biology has a limit. You can push it so far, and if you take it all in 1 year, you don't get it back year over year over year. And so one of the biggest solutions to, I think one of the biggest solutions to the short-term approach, which chemical fertilizers allow you to do, is longer term leases, a vested interest by that operator in a longer term. So that way they can justify putting in too much money that first year and have it pay back over 5-6 years. Right. If you end up writing a 1 year lease, 2 year lease, 3 year lease is pretty common. You can't justify putting money into properties. We have a lease that we put, we rebuilt their lambing barn, and it was on a 3 year lease. That's a crazy investment for anybody to do, because you can lose that immediately, and we don't get paid back from that barn right. for year five. And we did it because we have a good relationship and we value that process. But still, I think it's really important, if you do own land and you're leasing it out to operators, to really understand the value of finding a good operator that cares about the ground, that doesn't just sell a bill of goods, that actually does the job and has a vested long-term interest in your ground. You're going to end up with a better management strategy and a better ecology within your ground. I'm throwing a lot of big words that probably are misapplied, but whatever.
I can't spell most of what you just said, but that's okay.
I said blah, 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 blah.
So I think anybody that has built a livestock business based on leases has lost a lease to somebody that undercut them.
Yep.
And we had...
The highest priced rent paid in the Montezuma Hills right now is on the poorest managed piece of ground.
Yep.
It's literally turned into a feedlot. It's 300 acres of overstocked, eaten down to nothing, terribly managed property, and it's because they're paying the most rent. And anybody that has a conscience isn't going to pay that rent because they can't afford it and maintain the
yep.
biological health of that property.
Yep. Yep.
And if that landowner decided to lease it to someone else, we could change that biology in 2 years. We can get it back to full production. But you have to want to do that from a landowner perspective.
And you got to understand the economics of doing that. From a
Absolutely.
Landowner perspective.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we had a irrigated pasture lease that we'd been on 3 or 4 years, and the landowner came and said, somebody's offered me twice what you're paying. I'll give it to you if you can match what they pay. And no, I can't do it. And the new tenant lasted 18 months. And by month 12, he quit paying rent. And by month 18, they kicked him off and had totally scalped the ranch. But I think that's one of the challenges with landowners that don't necessarily understand that commitment.
And here we are talking about community and how great it is to be part of this organization, but the industry, it is important. I mean, there is people who do that. There is people that are going to lease a piece of ground for too much money. They're going to burn it down, take every single inch of protein they can off of it and sell it, and they don't care the long-term effects because that's a business model that they developed. And everybody in the industry knows who they are too, so it's not like they hide who they are, but they're able to talk landowners into those things. But it's I guess getting back to this environmental stewardship idea, how can we do a better job, and I don't know how to ask this question, but I don't know, you know what I'm asking? Like, it's hard for me to put it all together. Like, how can we as an industry and a community, like, how does community help discourage that kind of behavior?
I think that's an interesting question. I think in the community where I graze and where I've got my sheep, there are landowners that used to be in the business of doing this and aren't anymore, but still have a great appreciation for it. Now, I'm going to go a little bit in the weeds on this, but I think part of it is being an old timer is not a chronological condition. It's an attitude. And so we have relationships with people who have been in Auburn for multiple generations, who used to have livestock, who absolutely love having our sheep graze their property. and we do right by them. We do things above and beyond what you would do for a landlord. And they have never charged us a cent. I have a little irrigated pasture piece that I kind of happened upon. It's way too long a story, so I'll try to make it short. But older couple, been in Placer County for multiple generations. The man got Parkinson's. The wife had to have a pacemaker put in. And the summer she had the pacemaker put in, she's like in her mid-70s, she decided she probably shouldn't move handpipe that summer, which seemed like a reasonable concession to having a pacemaker put in.
My grandma had Navajo churros till she was 88.
So this is a place we've never paid a cent to graze. And I said, well, I'll move water this summer. Okay. So at the end of the summer, she tried to pay me for moving water on her ranch that she's never charged me for. And I said, no. And about 3 years later, Bud passed away from Parkinson's. And his wife brought me a card out and said, Bud wanted you to have this. I said, okay. I opened the card, and it's a card that says thank you from Bud, probably written in the last week of his life, with 10 $100 bills in it. And I had torn up the check they tried to give me, and she said, Bud knows you well enough to know you won't tear up $100 bills. But that's community, right?
Yeah.
That's community.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm going to go sideways and change subjects because that's what I'm good at, change orders. So one of the things he said is that in his, James Rebanks, in his book, he talked about they used to have cattle in their barns and they'd straw and bed, and then they'd take the bed and spread it on the field, the bedding. But then they switched to silage and it changed the acidity, which they still spread on the pastures. But I was fascinated by that. I never heard that before. Dan Macon, you're the best pasture geek I know. Like, what's the truth behind that? And what, you know, I mean, that's fascinating. I've always thought silage is such a brilliant product, but it sounds like there's some negatives to it that I didn't know existed. And I've never liked the smell of a dairy, so I kind of know. there is some truth to that, I think, but.
I think there is some truth to that, and I think it points to the complexity of these systems, right? That there are ramifications of decisions we make that we don't understand until well after we've made them, and it takes somebody like your grandpa or somebody like James Rebanks or his dad who have been there paying attention for a long time to kind of start seeing some of those ramifications and those changes. I also, I wonder, you guys talked about this a couple of weeks ago in terms of targeted grazing and grazing preferences and those types of things. I think there's so much we don't really understand about why animals graze what they graze and why they like what they like, that we could, if we paid more attention, we could use to our advantage.
Do you think we make a mistake? It's more of a cultural question. Do you think we make a mistake when we do equip grants or we fund different things that we come up with the idea and don't consult the people on the ground,
yes,
on the farms, and then we tell them they need to do this, but they never, like, there's these little pieces of information that if they would just have,
yeah,
it would be way better.
So we work with some folks that there are things called planning grants where you can get money to have focus groups with farmers and ranchers and get the kind of the on the ground information that you need to actually plan these studies. I think those should become a lot more popular because it makes a lot of sense. Like, we have an idea, but we don't have that on-the-ground expertise from generations of knowledge, where then we meet with you guys and can understand what are your thoughts about the idea that we have? Is it a good idea, bad idea? If it's a bad idea, what do you think needs to happen? And, you know, because if the idea was presented, it's because it's a priority area for someone. That's why they were funded. So what else can we do that's better? It's a planning grant. That doesn't mean the actual project is in progress, but it gets us, I think it puts us in a much better spot when those big projects are initiated.
And I think that can carry on through actually doing the research. Just finished a project where we were looking at early weaning as a drought strategy with cattle. And it was great because I was fortunate to have a rancher steering committee that looked at what we wanted to do. And then I had kind of the researchers on the other side, and I'm this guy in the middle trying to go, huh? And so the guy that was the pure scientist said, well, no, we got to wean the cattle this day because that would give us X number of days that we can measure the difference and all this other stuff. And Tim Reed, who was one of the ranchers on the steering committee, said, why would you bring cattle in specially just to do this? Why wouldn't you just wean calves when you were preg checking anyway? You're not going to set up your corrals just to bring cattle in. And so we did it that way. And it was a much more realistic experiment because the rancher was saying, I don't care what your arbitrary date is. Tell me what happens when I wean calves when they would be in the corrals anyway.
Well, and how many studies are done where the findings never actually reach it to producers because we can't figure it out as extension how that's applied?
Right.
You know, so it's great information. And then usually in their conclusions, they say the next steps are. And so, okay, well, what if we were even better yet started off with, okay, well, this is how we see what you're doing could apply to our operation.
Yeah.
And then we test that in a true form.
So we've covered a lot of ground. This is good. So is manure off of dairy cow or off of silage fed livestock, is it more acidic than others?
I would suspect that if you've got a more acidic environment in the rumen.
And if we could.
But I don't know that.
So the pH of manure and urine and a lot of that has a lot to do with the metabolic process too. So it depends on her energy requirements and how much she's putting into that. So, I mean, I think it's a very complicated system.
Yeah, but so if you have a situation where you're feeding silage, you have a more acidic product that you're putting out there, you can combat that with new technology by incorporating lime and still benefit from from that material. So you can take a new technology, blend it with this new feed and still maintain soil health, but you have to pay attention to that soil health, right? And maintain that good ecosystem. And I think one of the bit for me, the biggest takeaway from this conversation is that every ranch is so much more different than I've thought. And I've always thought that they're so different, but and even his book talks about, I felt like the biggest criticism of his book is I felt that, like, when he criticized the American production system, he was looking too broadly on one system, which is a Midwest corn. And I think if you really dig into that Midwest corn soybean rotation, there is a lot of neat things going on there. And but that's not California at all.
Right.
And California is not Rio Vista, and
right.
Rio Vista is not Auburn, and Auburn's not Woodland, and
right.
Woodland's not Dixon, and Dixon's not Sacramento, and all of that's within 30 miles. You know,
like, well, and I'll bring us back to the whole idea of sheep, because we're talking about being at the California Wool Growers. There's a one of my favorite Wendell Berry essays is about, it's called Let the Farm Judge. And the opening paragraph says, in an island the size of Kentucky, there are 80 distinct sheep breeds. Every one of those breeds was developed to fit a particular place on the island of Britain. And they fit the grass that grows there, they fit the system of production, they fit the rainfall pattern. That's what's so cool about sheep. There's sheep that fit everywhere. And that the diversity that was in this room the last 2 days represents that diversity in terms of sheep production, right? That's what's so cool about what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just to tailcoat on that, if you're in California and you produce sheep, it's so important to join
the wool growers. Not to plug that the wool growers is the greatest organization in the world, but you need to get involved and go to, you know, engage with people, engage with other producers, talk to them about what's working at their place, what's not working at their place. I can attest it's super intimidating to come to some of these conventions when you don't know anybody, but it is, it sometimes takes 2 to 3 years of going to actually get to know anybody. But once you can kind of break through that shell, it's incredible what you can learn and how much you can get. But
I finally know Ryan and Dan.
Yeah.
So come talk to
Rosie
me.
Rosie finally
know
knows two people at the convention.
Yay!
Now.
No,
so.
I met a lot more.
She met like another one yesterday, yes. Another person. Yeah. They had sheep. It was one person and they had sheep. It was a really good conversation. So, but no, I really do think it's important. I think one of the struggles that we face as a culture as a whole is we've devalued these types of organizations. We don't participate, we don't engage the same way we used to, and we don't take them as seriously as we used to. And I think it's really important that you vest yourself. So this is a complete aside and probably not appropriate for the podcast, but who cares? When I was shopping for a house, I was looking in Rio Vista and I was looking in all the surrounding cities. And when I told my grandfather, well, I'm really looking at Davis because they got a great school system. It looks really, they got some good houses. It's a really nice place to raise a family and all those things. He sat me down and he said, no, Ryan, your ranch is in Rio Vista. You live in Rio Vista. You need to vest yourself in Rio Vista and stay here. Don't look for what other places can do for you. Do something for the place that is providing everything for you. Because without them, without your town that I'm living in, I have nothing. And how irresponsible is it for me to just move away and depend on somebody else rather than actually put my sweat equity into the community that is giving me so much? You have an obligation to where you live. You have an obligation to the industries you're in to actually put that sweat equity into making it better.
Yeah.
Don't shop for what's the best, what can do the most for you. You really try to give yourself and your time and your expertise to them. So anyway.
I think that absolutely applies to organizations too. And if you're not a California Shepherd, join the organization where you are. If there's not an organization, start one. I follow a group from Mongolia that's all about nomadic herding, and it appears to be driven by the people doing the herding. That's awesome. That is community, right?
Yeah.
And so I guess part of the benefit of social media and the internet is that our sense of community can be focused geographically, but it can also be this larger community of people that are tending sheep or tending goats, or because we can learn from them too, right?
Double mic.
I don't know. If you're intimidated to come to this meeting, come and find me. I'm happy to talk to you. I'm the friendly face you can find in the crowd.
Yeah. She gives 3 or 4 presentations a meeting, so you can.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you guys for the conversation. I think we're at like an hour and 15 minutes, hour and 20 minutes.
Thank you for the beer.
Yeah, no problem. But this was great. I really enjoyed it. For Sheep Stuff You Should Know, this is Ryan Mahoney, Dan Macon, and Rosie Bush signing off from the great city of Bakersfield, California.
And just a shout out to the cameraman, sound man, mixer man,
producer extraordinaire,
John Kidwell.
Juan Davide Kidwell. Juanathan Kidwell.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks. Bye.